Geekscape.com.
White Supremacy and Negro Subordination, Part 2. Causes of Popular Delusion, Part 2. It is not intended to sneer at or to indulge in unkind criticism on missionary efforts. On the contrary, it is frankly admitted that they sprang from the sincerest convictions and were generally pursued with an utter disregard of selfish and mercenary considerations. But in not understanding the diversity of races, these efforts were more likely to do harm than good. A man's first duties are to his own household, and no amount or extent of benefits conferred upon strangers can excuse him for neglecting the former. And even if the heathen, the Negro, Indian, and Sandwich Islander had been benefited by the efforts of Wilberforce and his followers, the neglect of the ignorant, darkened, and miserable millions of their own race was a wrong that scarcely has a parallel in history. But they did not benefit the subordinate races, but on the contrary, assuming them to be beings like themselves, when they were widely different beings, they necessarily injured them. And when it is reflected that they not only neglected the ignorant and degraded multitudes of their own race, but got up a false issue in order to distract the attention and conceal the wrongs of their own people, then an unequalled crime was committed. The government of England, which is simply an embodiment of the class to which Wilberforce belonged, acted in concert with these religious efforts, and thus we see the leaders of the popular cause in the old world, Fox and Robespierre, the church and aristocracy, all acting together in a common cause, and labouring, in fact, to retard the progress and the liberation of millions upon millions of their own race, under the pretense, and doubtless with many in the belief, that they were labouring for the benefit of the Negro and other subordinate races. The government expended about 1,000 millions to crush out American liberty in 1776, but it is quite likely that an almost equal sum expended for the professed benefit of the Negro has accomplished vastly more than all other things together to protract the liberation of her own masses. It has been estimated that 600 millions have been expended nominally to put down the slave trade, but in reality to pervert the natural relations of races and force the subordinate Negro to the status of the British labourer. The interest on this enormous sum is annually drawn from the sweat and toil of the English masses, and every hut and cottage in the British Islands is forced to surrender a portion of its daily food or of the daily earnings of its owner to pay the interest on money squandered on the Negro in America. The amount thus paid, properly expended, would be amply sufficient to give a good English education to the entire labouring class, but that would be an overwhelming calamity to the governing class, who could not retain their power for a single day after the masses were thus enlightened. A few years since, famine and pestilence swept over Ireland, carrying off some 3 million of the Irish people, all of whom might have been saved if the annual amount wasted on Negroes in America had been applied to this beneficent and legitimate purpose. Indeed, it is quite possible that if the money wrung from the sweat and toil of Irish men alone for the pretended benefit of the Negro had been appropriated to the relief of the suffering multitudes of that unhappy people, few would really have perished. The mortgage on the bodies and souls of future generations of British labourers for the avowed purpose of doing good to to the Negro, enormous as the amount may be, and it has been estimated as high as $1,000 million, is only a portion of the vast waste and wholesale destruction of property involved in the British Free Negro Policy, also called schemes of philanthropy. Farms and plantations in Jamaica and other islands, valued at £50,000 prior to the emancipation, were afterwards sold with difficulty at £10,000 and even £5,000, and indeed extensive districts were abandoned by their unfortunate owners. An infamous system of fraud and inhumanity practiced of late years on the ignorant and simple Chinese and other Asiatics has enabled some planters to recover and restore their wasted and plundered estates, and the vile hypocrites who filled the world with their doleful lamentations over the sorrows of Africa not only wink at this infinitely greater wrong practiced on Asiatics, but resort to the effects attending it as a proof that emancipation has not ruined these beautiful islands. Could audacity and hypocrisy surpass, or did they ever surpass, this shameless fraud? But this new and vastly more atrocious system of man-stealing is transitional and temporary. The Mongol, or Asiatic, is rapidly worked up and destroyed in the West Indies, and as no females are introduced, they can never become an essential or permanent element of the population. The Negro, forced from his normal condition and into unnatural relation to the white man, must relapse into his African habits just as fast as the white element disappears, and as the latter is relatively feeble, the time must soon come, unless we take possession and restore the natural order, when civilization itself will utterly perish and the great heart of the continent be surrendered to African savagism. The eternal and immovable laws, fixed forever in the heart and organism of things, cannot be changed or modified by human folly, fraud, or power, and therefore the climate, the soil, the producers, and the means that the Almighty has ordained shall be used to make them tributary to human welfare, have their fixed and everlasting relations since time began. The brain of the white man and the muscles of the Negro, the mind of the superior and the body of the inferior race, in natural relation to each other, are the vital principles of tropical civilization, without which it is as impossible that civilization should exist in the great center of the continent as that vegetation should spring from granite or animals exist without atmospheric air, and therefore thrusting the Negro from his natural sphere into unnatural relations with the white man necessarily destroys the latter and drives the other into his inherent and original Africanism. The delusion, the folly, or the fraud of Wilberforce and his associates in presenting a false issue to their own wronged and oppressed millions, and thus diverting their attention from their own oppressions to the imaginary sufferings of Negroes and other subordinate races, is so transcendent, its magnitude so enormous, that we have no terms in our language that can express it. But great, and indeed awful, as may be this wrong on the white man, it is in some respects really surpassed by the evils, if not the wrongs, inflicted on the Negro. More than 1 million Negroes are believed to have perished through the means resorted to suppress the slave trade, and now it is admitted that those attempts have not prevented the importation of one single Negro. The world needed the products of the tropics. The labour of a certain number of Negroes were needed to furnish these products, and therefore, when 50,000 were required to Cuba, 80,000 were shipped on the African coast, thus leaving a margin of 30,000 to be destroyed by interference with the laws of demand and supply. Who can contemplate these frightful results without awe and sorrow and pity, not alone for the victims, but for the authors of such widespread and boundless calamity? The Crusades of the Middle Ages are now recognized as utterly baseless, simple human delusions in which millions of lives were sacrificed, not to an idea, but to a false assumption, an assumption that the Holy Sepulchre could be recovered at Jerusalem. That crusade of humanity in behalf of the subordinate races set up by Wilberforce and his associates in modern times is also a simple delusion based on a false assumption, the assumption that Negroes are black, white men, or men like ourselves, and though not so fatal to human life as the former, its effects or influences on human welfare are vastly and immeasurably more deplorable. Such is the great anti-slavery delusion of our times. It is wholly European and monarchical in its origin, and leaving out of view all other considerations, its mere existence among us, or that any considerable number of Americans could be so deluded and mentally so degraded as to endorse it, will astonish posterity to the latest generations. We are in contact with the Negro. We see he is a Negro, a different being from ourselves. We will not, even the most deluded abolitionist, will not, in his own case or family, act on the assumption that he is a being like himself. Indeed, would rather see his child carried to the grave than intermarried with a Negro, however rich, cultivated and pious, and rather than thus live out his own professed belief, he would prefer the death of his whole household. The European, on the contrary, naturally enough, supposes the Negro to differ only in colour, and the monarchist, the enemy of democracy, the man opposed to the great principle of equality underlying our system, just as naturally, demands that we shall be consistent and apply it to Negroes. But instead of enlightening this European ignorance and indignantly rejecting this monarchical impudence, which proposes that we shall degrade our blood and destroy our institutions by including a subordinate race in our political system, we have foolishly, wickedly, and abjectly assented to the European assumption, and millions of Americans have based their reasonings, and to a certain extent their actions, on this palpable, fundamental, and monstrous falsehood. Those portions of the country most directly under the mental dictation of the old world are those, of course, most given up to the delusion. But nearly the whole northern mind has adopted it as a mental habit. The time, however, has come when it must be exploded and the reason of the people restored, or it will drag after it consequences and calamities that one shudders to contemplate. 80 years ago, it was an abstraction, universally assented to, and just as universally rejected in practice. For all the states save one then recognized the legal subordination of the Negro as a social necessity, whatever the speculative notions were on this subject. They generally believed that in some indefinite or mysterious manner it would, or rather that the Negro would, become extinct, and as the industrial powers of this element of the general population was not specifically adapted to our then territory, all perhaps were willing to hope that it should some day disappear. But the vast acquisition of southern territory, the discovery and opening up of new channels of industry, and the extensive cultivation of those great staples so essential to human welfare, which are only to be attained on this continent by the labour of the Negro when directed by the white man, and moreover the rapid increase of this population and the certainty that it must remain forever an element of our population, demand that this mighty delusion shall be exposed, as it is in fact the vilest and most infamous fraud on the freedom, dignity, and welfare of the white millions ever witnessed since the world began.
You're tuned in to Radio Aryan.
Chapter 2. General Laws of Organization. The organic world is separated into two great divisions, animal and vegetable, or into animate and inanimate beings. In regard to the vegetable kingdom, as it is termed, it is not necessary to say a word. Those desirous of obtaining a thorough knowledge of animal life, however, had better begin their studies with the more elementary and simple forms of vegetable being. Many persons suppose that the whole animate existence is linked together by connecting or continuous gradations. In a certain sense, this may be said to be so. Nevertheless, absolutely considered, each family or form of being is a complete and independent creation. There are resemblances and approximations, as well as gradations, yet each is perfect in itself, and makes up an entire world of its own. The Almighty Creator, in his infinite wisdom, has provided against chance, or accident, or human caprice, and placed each and every one of his works in a position of such absolute independence that one of them, or more, perhaps, might utterly perish, and yet the beauty and harmony of nature would remain unimpaired. It is certain that some species of animals belonging to the existing order have utterly disappeared, and it is quite probable that some species of men have perished, but the grand economy of nature is unaffected by it. It is thought that the aborigines of this continent will in time utterly perish, and yet no one supposes that that event will disturb the operations of nature or deface the fair form of creation. This shows that there is no continuous or connecting link, even among species of the same family or form of being. If there were such, if all the forms of life were continuous and connecting gradations, then it is evident that the destruction of one of these connecting links would cast the whole economy of being into utter confusion. In a watch, or any other elaborate machinery of human contrivance, a single wheel, or cog, or link, however minute, torn from its place, involves the disruption, if not absolute destruction, of the whole machine. And so it is in the economy of individual life, for though one organ may be disabled, another, to a certain extent, and for a given time, supplies its place, yet the vital forces are enfeebled from the instant of such accident, and life, if not interrupted, is always impaired. But a species, a genus, a class, perhaps a great number of these might disappear, utterly vanish from existence, and those remaining would preserve the integrity and completeness the Creator has endowed them with at the beginning. While each and every form of life is therefore perfect in itself and independent of all others, there are resemblances and approximations that must be regarded as of vital importance. Naturalists have divided or separated the organic world into classes, orders, genera, species, and varieties. Classes are those like the mammalia, that is, all animals, where the female nourishes its offspring by mammary glands. Orders are those like the quadrumana, all those having four hands. A genus, or a family proper, is composed of species, and a species includes varieties, or possible varieties, of the same being under different circumstances. But these classifications are, to a considerable extent, arbitrary, And though they serve the purpose of facilitating our studies, they may also lead us astray if too closely followed. Genera, or families proper, in many cases at least, are, however, susceptible of very exact definitions. So too are species. For example, the Simiidae, or monkey family, are so entirely distinct that they will not be, or need not be, confounded with anything else. Some ignorant or superficial persons, with a false notion of continuous and connecting gradations, have supposed the Negro something midway between men and animals. But there is no such monstrosity in nature, for as already observed, each form of being is a complete and independent creation in itself. A genus is composed of a given number of species, all different from each other, and it need not be repeated, independent of each other. These genera, or genera, are believed to be incapable of interunion with other genera, though this has been questioned in some cases. Species are capable of a limited interunion, though it may be doubted if such interunion ever occurs in a wild or savage state. And as each species is different in form and character from others, so the limited capacity for interunion varies. Or in other words, hybrids, the product of different species, vary in their virility or power of reproduction. The given number of species, of which a genus is composed, ascends or descends in the scale of being. That is, there is a head and base to the generic column. The one next above, the most inferior, has all the qualities of the latter. But these qualities have a fuller development. That is, the organization is more elaborate, and the corresponding faculties are of a higher order. And indeed, this is not confined to mere species or genera, even, but is true of widely separated beings. Thus, the exalted and elegant Caucasian mother, the habitue of the Fifth Avenue, or Saint Germain, nourishes her offspring by the same process common to the meanest of the mammalia. So, too, in the process of gestation, the function of mastication, deglutition, digestion, the sense of taste, of sight, etc., the function is absolutely the same. But what a world of difference in the mode of its manifestation that distinguishes the human being from the animal. Investigations made by some French physiologists would seem to show that the mysterious problem of animal life might be simplified and clearly grasped by the human intellect by simply tracing this great fact to its elementary sources. It is said that the Caucasian embryo fetus passes through all the forms of an innumerable number of lower gradations before it reaches its own specific development. And be this as it may, enough is seemingly established to demonstrate its truth in respect to a genus or family, and especially it is demonstrated in the human creation. At a certain stage of fetal development, there is the cranial manifestation of the Negro, then the Aboriginal American, the Malay, the Mongolian, and finally the broad expansion and oval perfection of the most perfect of all, the superior Caucasian. Nor can these demonstrations be mistaken, for it is not a mere question of size, but of form. The Negro brain is small and longitudinal, thus approximating to the Simiidae and other animals. The Aboriginal is larger and quadrangular, almost square, in its general outline. The Mongolian, pyramidal, and still larger than either of the others. Finally, at the period of complete gestation, there is the full and complete oval development, alone peculiar to the Caucasian. The force of these distinctions may be easily grasped by the non-scientific reader by bearing in mind that a female of either of these races or species could no more give birth to a child with a cranial development of a race different from her own than she could to that of an inferior animal. The distinctions of nature, or the boundaries which separate even species from each other, are absolutely impassable. Each has the hand of the eternal impressed upon it forever, which neither accident nor time can modify in the slightest particular. They have, it is true, a limited capacity for interunion, and we sometimes witness the disgusting spectacle of a white woman with a so-called Negro husband. But while the offspring of this unnatural connection is limited in number, they partake of the nature of both the parents, and thus the birth becomes possible, though at the expense of great physical suffering to the mother, and perhaps in every case shortening her existence. In another place, this subject will be more especially discussed. It is only referred to in this connection to show the perfect order and harmony in the economy of animal life. The primal steps, the process of reproduction, the starting point of creation, being in complete harmony with the laws governing the being, man or animal, after it has reached its mature development. The same eternal separation of all the forms of being, and the same eternal approximations, however varied the manifestations may be at different periods, remain unaltered and unalterable. Linnaeus ventured to place man in the category or class mammalia, while at the same time he separated the mammalia from birds and other forms of being, thus assuming that the human creation had a closer union with pigs and dogs than the latter have with birds. At this, every Christian and believer in a future state of being must revolt, for though there are certain approximations that cannot be disregarded, nevertheless, it is absolutely certain that the human creation is separated by an interval wider than that separating any of the forms of mere animal life, and therefore his classification must be wrong. It is not intended to make this a scientific work, but on the contrary, to popularize for the general reading of the people some few elementary truths of zoology and physiology, in order that they can be better comprehend their subject matter really to be discussed, viz. The specific differences and specific relations of the white and the black races. But the author feels himself impelled to dissent from the classifications of Linnaeus and those modern naturalists who follow him, not only as being untrue in point of fact, but pregnant with mighty mischief. Linnaeus placed man in the category mammalia, but made him an order, a genus and species, by himself. This is false, as a matter of fact, for in the entire world of animal existence, there is no such fact as a single species. All the forms of life are made up of groups or families, properly genera, and each of these is composed of a certain number of species. These species, as already observed, differ from each other. They begin with the lowest, or simplest, or grossest formation, and rise one above the other in the scale of being until the group is completed, so that they are all not only specifically different from each other, but absolutely unlike each other in everything, in the minutest particle of elementary matter, as well as in those things palpable to the sense. Generally considered, they resemble each other, but specifically considered, they are absolutely distinct, and it need not be repeated. The distinction in each case or each individual species are also specific. that Linnaeus and other European naturalists, and especially the ethnologists, should make such a mistake and suppose that the human creation is composed of a single species is perhaps natural enough, for they saw but one, the 200 millions of Europe, except a few thousand Laplanders, being all Caucasians. But then it is strange how those so ready to class men with animals should so widely depart from the spirit and order of their own classification. They must have known that in the whole world of animate existence there was no such fact as a single species, and therefore, when assuming only a single human species, that they directly contradicted or ignored the most constant, universal, and uniform fact in organic life, a fact underlying and forming the very basis of all with which they were dealing. This mistake or misconception of ignorance of European ethnologists, however, is of no particular importance. They saw no other, and therefore could know of no other species of men except their own, and though its effect on ourselves has been mischievous, the cause of their misconception is so palpable to man's common sense that it only needs to be pointed out to be utterly rejected. It is about as respectable as the assumptions of the northern abolitionists, who, though not even venturing out of Massachusetts, affect to know, and doubtless really believe that they do know, more about the internal condition of South Carolina or Virginia than the people of those states themselves. But facts are stubborn things, and as the Spanish proverb says, seeing is believing. It is impossible that the northern abolitionist, who never ventured out of New England, can comprehend a condition of society that he has never seen. So too, the authority of European writers, necessarily ignorant of the subject, will be rejected by those whose very senses assure them that Negroes are specifically different from white men. And that mental dominion, which, beginning with the early planting of European colonies on this continent, has continued long after political independence has been secured, only needs to be cast off altogether to convince everyone of the utter absurdity of European teachings on the subject. There is an objection to the Linnaean classification infinitely more important than his misconception in regard to species. He places his one human species, Caucasian, in the class Mammalia, and therefore assumes that the human creation has a closer connection with a class of animals than those animals themselves have with some other forms of animal life. For example, men, and white men too, approximate more closely to dogs and cats than the latter do to owls and eagles. It does not help the matter to say that this is only in their animal structures, for there is an invariable and imperishable unity between the material organization and the external manifestations or faculties, which is fixed forever, and the conclusion or inference from the Linnaean assumption is unavoidable. If men approximate more closely to a class of animals than these animals do to some other class, then it is absurd to suppose the purposes assigned them by the Almighty are so widely different as our reason and instinct alike impel us to believe. To hope for, or to believe in immortality, or in a destiny so transcendent, while beings that closely resembled us perished with this life, in common with those still farther separated from themselves, was such a contradiction to reason that men involuntarily shrunk from it, and the result has been to repel vast numbers of people from the study and investigation of this most essential element of all knowledge. The materialists promptly accepted it and wielded it with tremendous effect in advancing their gloomy and forbidding philosophy, while those impelled by that innate and indescribable consciousness of the soul itself, which, in its godlike knowledge, rises high beyond the realms of reason and mere human will, and assures them of a life immortal and everlasting, shrunk from all study or investigation of the laws of physical life, as if it involved consequences fatal to that higher life of the soul. The former said, and said truly, if men have a closer union with the quadrumana than the latter have with birds, then it is all nonsense to suppose that they have an eternity of life, while those separated by a still wider interval are limited to the present. And the only reply to their reasoning has been the refusal to investigate the subject, or to study the laws of God, and to admit, inferentially at least, that there was a contradiction between the word and the works of the Almighty. Nothing is more common than to find men of great intellect and intelligence on almost every subject except this, the most vital, indeed the foundation and starting point of all real knowledge. Especially are clergymen ignorant, and those who assume to be the interpreters of the laws of God are not unfrequently the most ignorant of the most palpable and fundamental of these laws. This should not be so, and in all reasonable probability would not be so, had it not been for the untruthful and unfortunate classification of Linnaeus. Instead of meeting the materialists on their own ground and showing them that however approximating to certain forms of animal life the human creation was, yet separated by an absolutely boundless as well as impossible interval, for the distinctions between them are utterly unlike those separating mere animal beings, they tacitly admitted the truth of their assumptions, and met it by a blind and foolish refusal to investigate the matter, indeed have generally cast their influence on the side of ignorance and advised against the study of nature and the noblest works of God. But there can be no contradiction. God cannot lie, and whatever seeming conflict there may be at times between his word and his works, a further study is alone needed to show their perfect uniformity. It is true that the physical resemblances between men and beings of the class mammalia seem closer than those of the latter and some other forms of life. But while there is also an eternal correspondence between structure and functions, it is rational and philosophical to suppose that the difference in the qualities or external manifestations is the safest standard of comparison. Or, in other words, whatever may be the seeming physical resemblance, the differences in the faculties show that the former are not reliable. For example, in contemplating the intelligence of certain quadrupeds and birds, can anyone suppose or believe for a moment that the difference between them in this respect equals or even approaches to that separating both from human beings? And in the present state of our knowledge, our ignorance of the elementary arrangement of organic life, it is surely safer and more philosophical to be governed by our reason rather than our senses, to accept the differences which separate human intelligence from the animal world as boundless and immeasurable when compared with the apparent physical approximations which seem to unite us with a class of the latter. In conclusion, it is scarcely necessary to repeat that there is a fixed, uniform, and universal correspondence between structure and function, or between organism and the purpose it is designed to fulfill. We do not know, nor need to know, the cause of this or the nature of this unity. We only know, and are only permitted to know, that it exists, and are not bound to accept the dogma of the materialists that function is a result of organism, nor that of their opponents, who still more falsely imagine results without causes, or that there can be functions without organism. Truth, in this instance, lies between extremes. Functions or faculties cannot exist without a given structure or organism, but they are not a result of that organism. They exist together, inseparably, universally, eternally dependent on each other, but not a result of either. To see, there must be eyes, to hear, ears, to walk, the organism of locomotion. To manifest a certain extent of intelligence, there must be a corresponding mental organism. But there is no such thing proper as cause and effect, nothing but fact, the fact of mutual existence.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.